Welcome to Historical Window, a program that lets you experience the past and treasure the history of the Boys Ford Band of Ojibwe through the voices of our elders. Today we'll be talking with Maurice Chosa.
But I was one of those guys, you know, since I lived in Pine Ridge, I was always on the other side of things. It's just like I took in speech class, we'd have these debates in class. And so one of the debates was rock and roll, good or bad. And of course, everybody signed up to be on the good, you know, so I signed up to be against it. Well, they scored the debate and my team won. And everybody was so mad at me. They forgot that I, just before that, about 2 weeks before, won the chocolate chicken at the Easter Hop, you know. I won the rock con, the bop contest, you know. But they believed that I just hated rock and roll. I had to dance. It was a record hop because we obviously couldn't afford a big band to come in there. But Get Rhythm, the song that we played in the finals, when I won the bop contest, and that was a song that, I mean, that's got a fast beat to it. And the way I danced, I didn't cut the beat in half like most of the guys did. They couldn't keep up with it. But I went full bore with it. I mean, my feet were moving right with the beat, no half-stepping with it. So I was in pretty good shape. I was sweating like a pig, and we got done, and they got done. Okay, you're the winner. Now you got to go out and do it again to show everybody, you know, solo out there with my partner. And of course, I'm still huffing and puffing, you know, but we got out there to Get Rhythm. And I'm just whipping it around out there, and I thought I was going to collapse before it got done. But
within the past week, unmistakable evidence has established the fact that a series of offensive missile sites is now in preparation on that imprisoned island. The purpose of these bases can be none other than to provide a nuclear strike capability against the Western Hemisphere.
I was really concerned about it, you know, the possibility of World War III and how it was handled in the first place. I didn't really agree with the way things were handled initially to begin with the start of it. You know, being brought up, you know, to be patriotic and to, you know, I wanted to join the service, you know, in case there was a fight. And then at the age of 18, when I was finally old enough, I did go ahead and join the Marines. And the Cuban Missile Crisis was a strong impetus for me to go ahead and make that move.
From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time, 2 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, some 38 minutes ago.
Yeah, it was quite a shock, although JFK made some mistakes, you know. Well, he was only human, I guess, you know. We haven't had a perfect president ever, in my book. Still, he was my commander-in-chief at the time, you know, and he was the leader of our country, and he was able to come back from his mistakes and basically rectify things that he had done wrong and get us back on the right track.
Mm-hmm. He thundered across the West upon a silver-white stallion, appearing out of nowhere to strike down injustice or outlawry, and then vanishing as mysteriously as he came. His sign was a silver bullet. His name was the Lone Ranger.
My first TV that I saw, I believe, was about a 12-inch screen. Of course, it's black and white. And I think it was the Lone Ranger that I saw. Very few people in my neighborhood had a TV, you know, and so we'd wind up with, the heck was it? I thought I'd never forget his name. Dennis. His family had one. His dad worked in a factory, so he had a house and a yard, and he had this little black and white TV. But most of it, we just listened to the radio. We'd gather around the radio and listen to the Green Hornet and the Thin Man and the Shadow and all these radio programs and listen to the news. And if the president would speak, you know, we'd listen to that. But when the, you know, TV first came on, it was really kind of hard to see. It was such a little dinky screen. But the initial days, it was more of a curiosity than anything, and nobody really thought much about it, you know, going to be that big a deal. And now it kind of drives people's lives, you know. It's like, say, the icebox, you know, in the refrigerator. Not many people in the early 50s, mid-50s, had had a refrigerator. I remember in Minneapolis, a guy would come by, and this is in 52. He had a horse-drawn cart with a bunch of blocks of ice on the back, and as he came into a neighborhood, all the neighborhood kids would get up on the back of the wagon. And then our job then, as he came to each house, somebody would run up and knock on the door and tell them the Iceman is coming so they could move stuff around, and come back and say, well, how much ice do you need? 50 pounds, 25 pounds. And he'd take his ice pick and he'd chop out a little block, and he'd throw his tongs on it and he'd carry it on in there. And we'd ride it on that thing, and for our reward, we got to eat ice chips in the hot sun. That was our big treat. And then we'd get to the neighborhood line, and we'd get off to avoid a big fight because they're the neighborhood kids in the next neighborhood would be, and they'd take over. So Woodstock wasn't a big deal, but now the civil rights part of it, that was, because I'd had issues growing up when I lived in Minneapolis. For instance, when I was in the third grade, my third grade class beat me up because they thought I was Japanese. Well, this is 3 years after World War II. I was, out in the sun, I was a lot darker. I can pass for white now. I can get pretty dark in the sun, and when I come into school in September, I spent the whole summer out. I'm brown as a berry, as my mother would say. And people thought I was Japanese. So one day at recess, I step outside, and my whole third grade class, girls and all, spent the entire recess just stomping me up again, just kicking the hell out of me while I was up against the wall. So and I went home, and Mom, I was taking my bath. And Mom saw the bruises on me, and she asked what happened, so I told her, and I says, what are we? Are we Japs or what? We never ever talked about being this race or that race. We just lived. And so she explained to me, well, you're an American Indian. You're as American as anybody. So I healed up, and I went back to school, and as we're getting ready to go out to recess, I told everybody, I'm an Indian. I'm as American as anybody. Got outside, and the class kicked the hell out of me for being a dirty Indian. That kind of helped with some of the problems that way, but you could see the issues, like when I went to school, because I was a dumb Indian, it was a feeling I gradually got is that I'm sat in the back of the class, whereas the normal deal was they would seat you alphabetically, A, B, C up front, well, my name starts with C, I should be up near that second row, but I was always stuck in the back. They'd be asking questions, if I thought I knew the answer, like all kids, I'd hold up my hand, but they never called on me because, what could I know, So there was a fair bit of racism and a need for the movement to happen. Luckily, Martin Luther King came on, and they were able to get some people like Rosa Parks and some of these other people to stand up and take the issue head on.
Of more than 8,000 men today tightened his hold on the Batanggan Peninsula on South Vietnam's central coast, trapping an undetermined number of
I've got my share of comments from civilians calling me a baby killer and stuff of that nature when I was getting out. But, I didn't really get on, since I really wasn't paying a whole lot of attention during this time period of what was happening in the world. Like I say, I was in my woods wandering phase, and so I'd be dropping, I was doing my own dropping out of society, so to speak, smoking some stuff that semi-legal, and some places is legal today and other places it isn't, and is my way of dealing with the nightmares and issues and things. And so for most of us that were in, didn't know what the truth lie. Where the truth lie? What is the truth? It's got to be somewhere in the middle, but what is it? And the politics of the war were such that as it was going on, that those that wanted to go were largely left in the States, and those that didn't want to go, I've seen it time and time again, were sent. Those that didn't want to go, they'd send them and keep the guys at home. They were volunteering to go. And that was kind of became the final issue when I got out. I was wanting to go back, and we're going to send you over here, and we're going to send you, and then you get to go. And the politics was driving me nuts, and I can't handle this anymore, so I got to. That's what basically drove me out. It happened, to all Indians. We all had our problems that way. We just had to kind of deal with it.
Historical Window is a production of KBFT and the Net Lake Radio Project. This program is made possible by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and the citizens of Minnesota.